step to your cult. Hard times for guys chasing the gold. Well, fortunately for me, the situation's wrong. Well, I don't have the sense to leave the fate of the crop in my hero hands. The time with
After a week's hiatus, we are rested, relaxed, and ready to go with another edition of the Fringe Average Podcast, episode 5 by my count, in Brooklyn, New York. Jason Parks in Washington, D.C., or suburban Washington, D.C., Pentagon City, which isn't even really a city, it's just a neighborhood in Arlington, Virginia. God, it's just awful. I'm Mike Farron. Welcome back. It's great to talk to you. How are you today?
I am well. How are you,
Mark? I'm splendid. I am splendid. I don't even know my own real name. I've been calling myself Mitch for a week and a half.
That's excellent. I like the name Mitch. It reminds me of a real genius.
It always reminds me of Mitch Kramer. That's a Mitchy, 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 Mitchy. We are back and at it again, and we got lots of great emails again. I mean, 2 weeks' worth of emails. It was really tough to kind of narrow it down.
There are too many good ones.
And maybe we'll hold some over for next week. We got a couple of late submissions. There's one in particular that I want to hold for next week. That was a really listen, the emails that you guys, if we don't feel like if we get to your email, we don't get to your email, it's like we're disappointed in it, or don't feel down about it, or we're giving you what's worth our time. We're reading all the emails, and there's a lot of good stuff, and I'm stealing all the information we're not using from there to use on the radio. So don't feel for a second like it's going for naught. Keep sending them, because it's my favorite part is going through the emails every week. I love it. There's just a ton of really great stuff. So please keep doing that. And we'll get into in a little bit some of the prospects that are off to good starts this year and slow starts, and watching a few. One of them actually turned back into a pumpkin right now in Milwaukee. Is Justin Grimm's down 5-0 in the second for Texas. So. We'll talk a little bit about some of that. We'll talk about some guys blowing up in the minor leagues, a couple of guys I saw last week as well. I should mention our musical guest this week is Bearcoat. Do you know anybody in that band?
Yeah, just me. Mostly just me.
We did get an email asking when the next album's coming out.
Man, I've been... We could talk to Joe Hamrahi about that, because he's been keeping me on the road pretty consistently so far this year, so I haven't had a chance to really get into my studio and finish the third record. The third record is completely written. It's I just need to, I actually took, the steps to record a few of the tracks, and I didn't like the way that the process turned out, and so we're going to kind of scrap it, me and my partner Shane, and we're going to... probably end up recording the album live instead of piecing it together like we had done for the first two records. Just going to take some more time. It's a conceptual record about being 20 and tan.
Nice.
Of what it's like to be young and stupid and brown.
This sounds like the soundtrack for the Mark Wahlberg movie that's coming out about the meatheads that are robbing banks.
Yeah, this is mostly about sitting on a beach and smoking weed and playing acoustic guitar and not really giving a fuck.
Well, that's
that age.
Oh, youth. How I missed that. Oh, that's cool. Well, we will keep an eye open for that. Hopefully it'll be down the pipe soon. The music today comes from Bearcoat, of course. You can contact us on Twitter. Jason is, of course, Professor Parks. I am Mike Farron, SXM. You can catch the radio program, if you like, on SiriusXM. Pay for a subscription so I can stay employed. We've got some reviews now. I don't know if you heard about the reviews that we've had from people in the media. Mike Rooney.
No.
Mike Rooney from ESPN, who does a college podcast of his own, great guy, referred to us as exceptionally profane, which...
That's accurate.
It's like, I love the information. They are exceptionally profane. So I thought that was a good line from him. So that's all coming up. And I've got to throw out a thank you, too, before we even really get rolling, to Jason Papke, who's one of our listeners who sent me a Kenosha Twins T-shirt this week. Kenosha's nice. Right up the road from where I grew up, and it used to be the A-Ball affiliate for the Twins, and he sent me a T-shirt this week. So that was really cool. I really appreciate that, man. So thank you very much for doing that. So, all right, and you can always email us. The email is fringeaverage at baseballprospectus.com, and let's go ahead and get started. The first email comes from Eric B., and he says, I listened to the first two episodes, both of which I've really enjoyed, but I'm a college baseball coach, and we hit the home stretch of our regular season, so I've not been able to listen to the last two episodes. I'm about 2 weeks behind on Effectively Wild, too, so I'm going to have to go on a fringe binge to catch up on everything. Note, I'd like to submit fringe binge, fringe binging, fringe bingers, or any other name that may emanate therefore as a relative for term for a point niner. I would just like to retain animation rights. In episode two, Jason talked about scouting games early in his career and his spring training process and the speed of the game, trying to watch every player basically do everything and how it eventually slowed down by watching game after game and learning how to watch and process the games better. My question is on the how. I really haven't had a mentor in the scouting process, and I've had to learn everything on the run through a series of trial and error. I'm smart enough to know that I'm not smart enough to remember everything and that I still need to take notes during the action that is taking place. I don't want to assume anything, but I'm guessing you still have some form of note-taking, and I'm curious as to what that might be. Aside from the quantity of games watched, was there anything you did to help speed up your process of slowing down the game? This question is directed to the professor, but anything Mike would like to add would be appreciated. Thanks, guys. I look forward to catching up on the shows. Eric B. Fun question, and I think a really good question for anybody who's trying to either aspire to be a scout or to understand the game more fully.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I used to take too many notes. You know, as I said in that episode, I mean, my head was down a lot. I was focused on what I was writing, whether it was legible, you know, whether I could look at that at another time and say, okay, I know what this is, or trying to express all these feelings that I was having, all these ideas or all these thoughts that I was having, trying to get these all down on a piece of paper without missing the next pitch or the, you know, the next exchange. So, you know, it started to slow down for me when I stopped taking as many notes, when I started, like, paying more attention to what was going on in the field without that, you know, that hustle of trying to document absolutely everything. I mean, I needed to trust my mind more. It's like, I have a memory. I can remember all this stuff. It's like, you know, it's not charting a pitcher. You know, that's something that's very specific. If I'm going to chart a pitcher, I'm going to just focus on this pitcher. You know, I'm going to focus on the location of every pitch and the velocity of every pitch, the situations involved. And I'm just going to sit on that pitcher and I'm not going to focus on a lot of other things, you know, but it's really difficult when you're trying to, you know, go to a game and quote unquote scout everything. I don't really think that that's a good idea, to be honest with you. You're going to miss too much. But you know, if I'm sitting on more than, you know, maybe just a bunch of position players, well, then I'm going to try to just keep my focus to them. I'm not going to take as many notes. I'm going to try to remember what they're doing. I'm going to try to, you know, acknowledge and notice trends just like I would if I were, you know, the catcher of that game. You know, I'm going to try to focus in that manner. And then after the game, I want to try to, you know, sit with it a little bit and think about what happened. And then if I need to put the notes down, I'll put the notes down when I'm writing the scouting report so that I then have that information. And when I started, you know, getting into that process more, I started to, the game started to slow down a little bit for me. I wasn't as rushed. I wasn't so focused on pen and pad. I was more focused on what was actually happening on the field and trusting, you know, my ability to remember and to recall that at a later point. And, you know, there are a couple people in the scouting industry who actually helped me get to that point by saying, you know, you're taking too many notes. You know, you're more focused on your notebook than you are on the field, and you're missing more than you think. And when I started to kind of take that to heart and pay more attention to what was happening on the field instead of what was happening in my notebook, it did start to slow down. I did start to retain a lot more information than I ever thought I could, and a lot more than I did when I was writing notes.
I'm not a scout, and so I try and view the game as much as I can, like I've been taught to, from, you know, either talking to scouts or talking to you, talking to you know, guys who really understand the game. But I think the idea of kind of narrowing your focus is the easiest way to get the game to slow down for you. If you're going to, you know, and it may be tough, you know, in Eric's situation, because he's a college coach, so he's looking for a lot of different things. If he's out on the recruiting trail and he's trying to scout players that, you know, could fit for his program, he's trying to see a whole lot of different things. Now, maybe if you've got an idea or two or three guys, you know, you can just kind of watch them. There are easier ways to watch. If you can trust your peripheral vision, I think that really helps defensively. One of the lessons I was taught was to kind of create a triangle with the defenders. So, you know, you would do it with the third baseman, the left fielder, and the shortstop, and watch that for a few pitches, and then the left fielder, the shortstop, and center fielder, and kind of working your way around the diamond like that, just in the periphery to try and see who's getting jumps and whatnot, and you can focus more if you need to. But I think that that whole process of working inside out, and it's easier to focus on the pitchers, certainly early on when you're learning, and then working out to the pitcher-batter matchup and then kind of seeing the whole game will help it to slow down some. But it still moves faster than I'd like, certainly, when I'm trying to look at things. And again, I'm not trying to evaluate from the standpoint of a scout. I'm trying to just learn, trying to see, trying to follow patterns that I can then talk about on the radio, but I want to try and do it with the most, you know, credible amount of information that I can, and that's not just from, you know, necessarily reading reports or reading what other people are writing about.
Right. I mean, and there are some scouts, they've been doing this for so long, they go to games so often that, I mean, they can tell things without finishing the play. I mean, like, they can tell by the sound of the bat. They don't have to track every single play to the degree that somebody like I have to, you know. I mean, or, you know, other like novice type scouting guys, is that, you know, we're out there trying to soak everything in because we don't have the experience not to. Now, these guys, they have the experience where they don't have to waste time. You know, they go to enough games. They have to put, you know, they're at 100-plus games a year, all, you know, in all different locations, in all different settings, and they start to, you know, it becomes an instinctual thing. It becomes second nature that these guys can just, you know, they know where the ball is going to go. They know where the pitch is going to go. They know why the pitcher is doing this. They know why the hitter is doing this. They spot trends a lot faster. These guys are the wizards, man. And it comes with experience. It comes with sitting at those fields all the time, all your life, you know. And maybe someday I'll get to a point where I feel comfortable with that. But I'm certainly not there yet. And, you know, I don't know many people who actually are.
Yeah. Our next email comes from Gabe. Hey, guys, first time emailing a podcast, so bear with me here. Great show so far. So good. I'm obsessed. Thanks for that. I think what sold me on the show was when one of you dudes referred to the Greinke Quinton saga as some Tupac and Biggie shit. I will forever chalk up a pitcher interviewed as some Tupac and Biggie shit. And to further solidify my obsession was the comment about Ted Williams wasn't sweeping bird shit off the runway. He was in the shit. I used the Ted Williams Fishing Hall of Fame fact to all my friends as a did you know, which nobody seems to know. Yeah, and all your baseball knowledge and content is pretty awesome as well, which is my great segue to an actual baseball question. I've been having this debate with my colleagues for years. When watching the Little League World Series, they always show pitchers' velocities and convert it to major league velocity. It seems like every kid throws in the mid-70s in their distance, and it translates to an MLB velocity in the 90s. So does that mean there are a bunch of 12-year-olds running around that can step into a batter's box and face Major League Baseball fastballs? Obviously, they're talking about reaction time, I would assume. The compared reaction time numbers are similar. But let's take out factors such as movement, sink, changing speeds, running fastballs, etc. Would a 12-year-old be able to step in a box and face someone like the Angels' Mark Lowe, who throws mid-90s, but is straighter than an arrow, and make contact? Just curious. I would assume this would be a better question later in the summer, but what the hell? Keep up the great work, guys. P.S. How many times a day does someone say Mike Farron sounds like Seth Rogen? Gabe. I suppose we'll address the Seth Rogen thing first. I should get this a lot, and I don't hear it at all. I mean...
I do.
Do you? I think we look more alike than we sound alike. I'm not Canadian, so that's where I'm thrown off.
Of course.
You think Seth Rogen and I sound the same?
Absolutely.
Is it the timbre of our voice, our vocal patterns?
It's I don't know, man. It's something. I don't mind it. I mean, it's not like I turn off his movies because I get sick of his voice, or I don't turn off your radio show because I don't like his movies.
No, no, you turn both of those off because the shit sucks.
Of course.
If you put a 12-year-old who's playing in the Little League World Series at mm-hmm. home plate against a 90-mile-an-hour fastball from 60 feet 6 inches, what kind of chance do you think the 12-year-old has?
Well, against Mark Lowe, pretty good.
Ranger hater.
I think it would depend on the kid. I mean, obviously, if you can control the bat well enough, I mean, they're not swinging a major league stick, and the ball's not going to go very far. But, I mean, if you can stand in that box and eventually time to it, you know, you can cheat your way into that. I mean, there's some kid who's going to have the hand-eye coordination to throw the bat out there and make contact with the baseball. Is he going to be able to hit against him? I think that's a different thing. No, he's not going to be able to hit against Mark Lowe. I mean, but if you were to, you know, take away the player, I mean, you'd put a pitching machine there since it's going to be straight, and put it at mid-90s and just let a kid stand in the box and take swings at it, somebody's eventually going to time to it and be able to make contact. I mean, they're not going to be able to hit in a game situation against that, but I do think that, you know, some kid, like a Jerickson Profar when he was 12 years old, standing there and probably make contact with a ball like that.
Yeah, but Jerickson Profar could do anything he wanted to do when he was 12. He probably could have played in the big leagues then.
He wouldn't have been afraid, and he probably thought he deserved to.
There's this long-standing argument about guys from other eras and whether or not they could play in today's game, and one of the arguments against guys that, you know, the Mickey Mantles and Willie Mays and guys who played, you know, two generations ago now, is because the velocity that they face would be significantly different. And I always felt like that would be the easiest aspect of it, right, is being able to time it if you're somebody like that. And that's why I figured that there's a 12-year-old, some 12-year-old could have a chance to make some contact just based on the fact that in the end it's timing. If you know it's straight, it's going to be in the same spot. Like you said, you're going to be able to cheat for it. And once you kind of get that figured out, you're going to be able to at least put the bat on the ball. But try and put them in a game situation and it's going to look like a 30-year-old pitching to a 12-year-old. I mean, I think you could say that for an 18-year-old. I think you could say that for most 20-year-olds who are really good baseball players. If you put them in the box against a major league pitcher, you know, not everybody is, you know, Harper, Trout, and Machado in that regard.
Oh yeah, sure. And then there are guys like even major leaguers who turn up the pitch machine to really create, like Lenny Dykstra. Those stories of him trying to hit, you know, 110 or 120, you know, all roided up and big ass chew in his mouth, and just trying to hit 120 like a freak. It's just about timing. You know, it's about when to cheat it, you know, when to get into the zone. But that's the difference between that and at game time, when the ball is coming out of a human hand, you know, and there's going to be different things that's coming out of a human hand. And it's not always at the exact same location at the exact same speed. So, you know, that's what I said. In a game situation, nobody would have a chance. You know, a kid wouldn't have a chance. But, you know, you put that kid in a pitching machine situation and let him time to it, you know, they're going to be able to – somebody's going to be able to eventually find the time and be able to stick, you know, put the wood on the ball.
How many pitches do you think it would take? For just, let's say, a 90-mile-an-hour fastball for a good 12-year-old hitter to time it? 20? 40? 100?
I'd say 10 to 20 for a really good player, yeah. You know, that's that age where, you know, those neurological skills are really starting to develop, and if they're an advanced 12-year-old, I don't see it taking that long for a kid to be able to time to it. Now, I mean, I remember being in a batting cage when I was really young and getting into the cage that I shouldn't be in, you know, the cage that it was way above my pay grade. Mm-hmm. Now, the ball's in a lot higher than I could hit, and so that was part of the problem, is adjusting my bat to that plane. But the velocity, I was eventually able to know when I needed to cheat to get there. You know, you just had to swing your swing really, really early. You know, you can figure that out. I just don't, I mean, against live pitching, I think that's when, you know, they would be a no, even against Mark Lowe.
Right, right. The next question is number three. Hang on, I'm going to turn the page here. Comes from Jeremiah. The question is, Mike and Jason, first off, your show is fucking fantastic. It's so nice to have a baseball podcast of substance to offset all the others that just recap what happened last night or spend a large portion of the show discussing how good the Yankees would have been if they were healthy and all 10 years younger. Okay, it seems like any time a team makes a change to anything, the talking heads make it sound like this was the one missing piece that was keeping them from the World Series. They moved the fences in, championship. They got their ace, championship. They shored up their bullpen at the deadline, championship. So I was wondering if you could enter a hypothetical world where you two were starting a franchise from scratch. I've listed some of the main pieces of a franchise and was hoping that you could order them from most important to least important. And here's the list that Jeremiah comes up with. Ownership, front office / scouts, coaching staff, defense, offense, starting pitching, bullpen, ballpark effects, mascot. To say the rally monkey who had a 9-3 war in 2002, that's a mascot wins above replacement. Keep up the work, great work, Jeremiah. This is my favorite question of the week.
this is crazy because, I mean, it's, you know, you could start a number of different ways. I mean, obviously there's going to be some sort of trickle down, but, you know, at least for me, even before the talent, and I know talent wins out, I think that you have to have the front office and the scouts because they're the ones who are going to be able to keep the pipeline of talent stocked. That's the most important thing to me. Even with poor ownership, good scouts can go find talent.
Yeah, I had that number one, and I had ownership number two, because you need to be able to have owners that are willing to commit to the vision of the front office and the scouting department. If you're starting really from scratch, I mean, if we're breaking down from ground zero, we're a new franchise or an expansion franchise, I think that those are two important aspects. I think you can win with bad ownership, but I think having good ownership in that scenario really makes things a lot easier.
Yes.
And I think it is very important to have owners that are willing to trust the people that are making the decisions. And I put that at the top of the list before the players. And third, I actually separated it out because I have coaches way down on the list, at least from the major league staff standpoint. But I think development people, if you were to put out coaches for the development system from throughout the minor leagues, those that are, you know, helpful in getting players to, you know, understand who they are and what their strengths are, I think that that's almost as important as the scouts, the front office, and the ownership.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly want to give credit to the player dev guys, but when I look at player dev, I look at guys who have to, you know, have the talent to work with. You can't, the best talent, best player dev guys in the business can't make shit shine. You know what I mean? So you have to start with something better than shit. And I think that's where you have to start with. That's when the talent comes in for me. Is it would come in after the front office and the scouts and the ownership, and I'd go right to starting pitching.
Yeah, it's the first on my list too. What did you have after that? What was after starting pitching?
I didn't actually make a list. I'm making it now as we go along. I didn't realize
that's want.
You know, I'm a big defense guy. I like defense more than offense, especially if you're going to build around starting pitching. So I'd go starting pitching, defense, offense.
I went starting pitching, offense, defense, bullpen, then coaches, then mascot, then ballpark effects. I think ballpark effects is the least important part of the whole thing. In fact, what irritates me is when organizations, franchises use the ballpark as an excuse. You know, we've heard it a lot in Colorado. You know, in their the fact that the ballpark, what was it that they called it last year, the behemoth or something like that? They had some derogatory name that they called it behind the scenes because of the impact that it has on their team. And the fact is that it's just a way to hide from the fact that you haven't done a very good job developing starting pitching. And in the end, the ballpark can just become an excuse. I don't think ballpark effects is really that big a deal in the end.
I think that, you know, you can since we're building from the ground up, I mean, we can build around whatever we're given, you know, and so we can make those adjustments. You know, we're not going to, if we're playing in, you know, a really huge park, I mean, we'll adjust around that. We'll start to look at talent that is a good fit for that park, but it doesn't necessarily have to be that because, I mean, I do think that talent is talent is talent. So, I mean, I would actually put the mascot above that because I do like a good mascot.
Do you have a favorite right now?
I don't.
Mr. Celery in Wilmington doesn't do it for you?
I was about to say, I do like the creepier minor league mascots. You know, they're in really bad costumes, and you can see the person underneath the costume pretty easily, and, you know, it's scaring kids. It's not even for the kids. It's scaring adults, and it's, you know, I love those mascots. Uh-huh. Those are the best.
I don't want to say devil's advocate. Let me take it to the next level on this question. If you were taking over an existing franchise, would your list change at all? If you're not starting it from the ground up and say, okay, you're taking over a team that's, you know, bad or even mediocre. I guess there's a big difference between what you would look for bad and mediocre. Does the list of things that you would want change?
I think the hierarchy could change once it reaches the talent level. I mean, I think for me, first of all, it has to start with the front office and scouts. If you're only as good as your scouts and your player dev guys, so I mean, I would definitely, you know, go heavy on the scouts. They have to go find the talent. You know, they have to, if you have bad ownership, you know, the best scouts in the world can go find you the best talent. I mean, these guys, that's be the number one for me. But then the hierarchy of talent itself. If I were taking over a franchise, and if I'm taking it over, it's probably in really shitty shape. I'd just go for whatever talent I could get, whether it was pitchers, whether it was defense first guys, whether it was all bat. I mean, I would just look to acquire as much talent as possible and then let it sort out, let the coaches sort that out, and then the coaches would be higher up on the list.
Our next question comes from our buddy Downstate Chad. It says, hello again, Mike and Jason. I'm absolutely loving the podcast. Please keep up the good work. I'm coming to you with a relationship question. That may seem strange that one would seek insight into relationships from a baseball podcast of an explicit nature, especially when at least 50% of said podcast has been very candid about failed relationships. But I would classify this specific relationship question as fringe average, so you guys may be able to lend some insight. Baseball seems to be a community of tightly connected components who all rely upon each other to meet their objectives. Front office, coaches, agents, scouts, players, broadcasters, writers, etc., all depending on each other to do their jobs throughout all of baseball's levels. And while personal differences can often be present in these relationships, I don't believe an entire category of people within baseball is dismissed or ostracized by every other group to the extent of umpires. What got me thinking about this was listening to the KNBR broadcast through my At-Bat app on the Giants-Padres game last Saturday. John Miller and Dave Fleming, two of my favorite broadcasters, two of mine too.
Same here.
And two seemingly affable gentlemen were pulling no punches in their criticism of Hunter Wendelsohn's strike zone consistency. My first thought was the typical, well, these guys are definitely not planning on a post-game drink-up with the umps. But I kept thinking about it. The type of criticism being offered by Miller and Fleming is certainly not rare in the broadcast booth. In addition to his hold on flat earth society baseball principles, Hawk Harrelson is universally known for his umpire character assassinations. Nor are umpire takedowns absent from written commentary of games, and we are all familiar with social media's reaction to the umpire performance failures. Hashtag robot umps now. But my question isn't about the criticism itself. Every other group in the baseball community is subject to the very public criticism, but as a community, they seem to be able to maintain their relationships. I'm curious where the professional umpire fits into the baseball community, if at all. Jason, with your connection to the scouting industry and your place among the baseball writing community, have you had or do you have any friendships with umpires? How are umpires viewed within scouting, if at all? Mike, with your experience in play-by-play broadcasting, what is your take on the relationship between broadcasters and umpires? Are announcers encouraged to call the umpires out to add color to the broadcast, or is an opposite directive in place to be careful with that type of commentary? To both of you, if the umpire is in fact excluded from the community, is it a result of the nature of the job, or is it the typical nature of the person who seeks employment as an umpire that keeps him on the outside? After all, what kind of person wants that fucking job? Thanks, guys. Downstate Chad.
And I have a lot of respect for umpires because I know how difficult it is for those guys to actually make it up to the highest level. I mean, it's probably a lot harder than it is for a player to make it up to the highest level. I go out to the Fall Instructional League a lot, or the AZL, and I see these guys out there, and it's 110 degrees, and they're wearing all this gear, and they're getting yelled at, and they're officiating really sloppy baseball that can take a long time. And a 3-hour game at that level is like a 6-hour game. I mean, it's like it's giving birth. It's terrible. And these guys go out there and do it. And I do often think about, like, what are these guys even thinking about? Why do they want to do this? Well, I mean, they must have serious, serious want to put themselves in that position to do it. And I respect that. And, you know, I know sometimes that they can make the job about them, as we saw with the Harper rejection, you know. It becomes a bit of an ego thing. But, you know, for the most part, I don't have a problem with umpires. They're doing their job. I'm doing my job. It has nothing to do with their job. And, you know, I just respect it for what it is, but I don't have any umpire friends. They usually just leave the field. I don't know any, personally. Do you? Do you know any umpires?
I know a former umpire fairly well, Jim McKean, who was an American League umpire and then an umpire supervisor, has been a frequent contributor on the radio show. Over the last couple of years, and I've gotten to know Jim, and I like Jim quite a bit, and Jim's a big baseball fan and loves the game and played it, collegiately, and so he's got an understanding of, how the game is played. I'll look at it from a little bit from the broadcasting side, because I'll put it this way, I've never heard anyone be told you should really do a good job of, or you should criticize the umpires as a way to add color. Nor have I heard anyone say you shouldn't say anything about it. And I think that personally, if I can soapbox for a minute, I think most major league broadcasts now do a really shitty job of covering umpiring because it comes off like they're a bunch of whiny bitches.
That's great.
I was listening to a game in the car last night, and all I was hearing about, and it, apparently the complaints went from both teams, but was how wide the umpire strike zone was. That one was over the chalk, so of course it's a strike. Hey, grr, 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 right? And you know, tonight I was watching the Tampa Bay game on TV, and Marty Foster, who blew the strike three call in that game against Texas, blew a call at home plate. Sean Rodriguez slid home safely, and he ruled that he'd missed the plate, and then he was tagged out by J.P. or Encibia. And the broadcasters did a little bit better job on that, but they talked about how he had clearly missed the call. I think for the most part, I think broadcasters can do themselves a disservice. I know at least one umpire that has stiffed one of our hosts when he went to shake his hand because of some comments that he had made about him. And I think that's, I don't necessarily fault him for that. I mean, you're criticized an awful lot from it. I don't fault our host either for criticizing him because the guy deserved to be criticized. But I do think that the broadcast element of it has become this. It's really easy to focus on the umpires because it makes a convenient excuse for fans to be able to buy into with an underperformance of the team. You know, whether it's a one day or over the course of a season or over the course of a game, and I think it becomes a really lazy way to go about doing a broadcast to just say, he's consistently been bad, and to single out every single call. Where was that pitch? Boy, that was another one he missed, all of that. You can do it quickly and concisely, and you don't have to do it after every pitch to say that a guy might be struggling behind the plate. It is part of telling the story. But I do think broadcasters now have just, it's blame the ump for everything. And I think the ump show shit on Twitter, and I've made plenty of jokes about the robot umps and even tried to, push my co-hosts on saying, hey, listen, if there's more technology, how can it help to make things more accurate? I think it's blown way out of line. And I think that, this whole idea that every time there's a missed call, that it's the worst thing that's ever happened to society. It's gotten to the point now where I just want to say, just stop. Unless you're going to come up with a solution, a legitimate solution for how the umpires can get better, keep your mouth shut.
That's awesome. Yeah, there's a lot of reactionary assholes out there. That's a great comment, though.
But I do think that the umpires, I don't think that they're ostracized from the community, though. And I think that was the other point that Chad wanted to make. I mean, I certainly don't feel that way. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think while the relationships have changed between players, managers, and the umpire, that it's not necessarily as cordial as it was, 20 years ago even. And McKean made a really good point on this, saying, he thought a lot of it had to do with the fact that, there was a separation of the umpires and leagues, so you got to know the guys better. So AL umps were always doing AL games, so they got to know the players, so there was more of a trust factor. But I don't think that there's any – I certainly don't think that there's that level of rancor generally between players, coaches, managers, management, and umpires. I think it's more general towards the umpires as a group. I don't think it very rarely gets personal. So our next email comes from Zach. Hey, fellas, so yesterday after Clay Buchholz throws another early season gem for the Sox, Blue Jays radio TV announcer and a guy who really brings the fringe average to Hall of Fame discussions, Jack Morris, accused Buchholz of throwing a spitball. Now, I sort of treat doctoring the ball like I do PEDs. These guys are pretty much doing anything they can to pull a fast one and get better, win, get more cash. Having said that, what exactly does Morris gain for the team he works for by bitching about this? Is this just a way for him to get into Buchholz's head? Is this a legitimate complaint that one guy on a rival team is doing something that nobody else is doing? Is this a, hey, vote for me because I played the game the right way, last-ditch Hall of Fame cry for help? All I can imagine is that in the clubhouse in Toronto, there's a pitcher or two saying to themselves, God damn it, Morris, now we're all going to be looked at closer, and I'm going to lose 10 days of pay at some point. Anyway, thanks to the podcast, fellas. I enjoy the work, and may your beers continue to hold their respective chills. Thanks, Jack. What'd you think of Jack Morris's comments? Or Zach, not Jack. What'd you think of Jack's comments?
Maybe he's right. I mean, he might, he probably did it himself. He's able to recognize that kind of stuff. I heard Schilling talk about it afterwards, and he seemed to have some, seemed to be pretty familiar with it himself, of the different tricks that a pitcher will do to doctor the ball, whether it's cut it, whether it's put sandpaper on it, whether it's putting, Bardol or Vagisil on your body. and then rubbing it on the ball. I don't have a problem with Morris saying it. I don't have a problem with Buchholz trying it if that's what he was trying. I mean, I can't speak to Morris's agenda, obviously, and I don't really care about Morris's agenda. I do think that he would be a type of guy in the era he pitched in that he would be able to recognize when some guy's getting a little bit juicy with the ball. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it's, one, happening, or two, that he has a specific agenda. I mean, he might have a specific agenda, or he just might be noticing that, you know, yeah, another player, this he could be doctoring the ball. I am picking up some things that he is doctoring the ball. I don't know. Did he go into detail about it, or was it just left like that?
Yeah, no, there was – so what happened was it was actually Dirk Hayhurst, the former podcast guest on Up and In, that pointed out that something was amiss because Buchholz was going to his forearm between pitches. And that's, if you watch Buchholz closely, especially from the stretch, he's got a lot of idiosyncrasies. He'll wipe off on his backside, he'll wipe off on his shoulders. He always dumps water over his head right before he goes to the mound, so he'll grab his hair to try and get some moisture. And he will have sweat. Yeah, it is wet, yeah. And he'll have sweat on his forearm, and he's one of those guys that bounces the rosin bag up and down on his forearm, on his left forearm, before he takes the mound. And so what was happening was that he was going to taking two fingers and rubbing them on his left forearm and then grabbing the ball and taking it. It was pretty clear to me that it was rosin that was on that. There was some talk. Hayhurst later said he thought it was sunscreen. But after this got showed to Morris, Morris went ballistic. And then he went to John Farrell and told him he thought that was happening. And he went to both of the Red Sox catchers in the clubhouse, including telling David Ross, when Ross kind of blew him off on it, said, "Hey, this ain't my first fucking rodeo." As if he knew exactly what was happening with it. The Red Sox have, of course, downplayed it. I really don't think that Buchholz was doing... If Buchholz is tampering with the ball somehow illegally, it's to get tack. It's to get some sort of grip on the ball. It wasn't to make it move more. The guy's always had a two-seam fastball that's run. And I think everybody we've talked to, you know, we talked to Ron Gardenhire this morning, who faced Buchholz last night, and talked to his manager, John Farrell, who, of course, is going to defend Buchholz. But he said, you know, the guy's always had a ton of movement. I don't put a whole lot of stock into it. In fact, I think the people that there have been more people who have said, I really don't think it's a big deal, than there have been ones who said, I think it's a big deal, who've played the game. I think the ones who've said, I think it's a big deal, have said so louder.
Well, I mean... Look, if you watch, like, I know everybody watches every Darvish start, right? I mean, it's must-see TV. He goes to his forearm after every pitch.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there's honey on his arm, but it has nothing to do with baseball.
It's because he sweats honey.
He just sweats pure honey. And if you sweat honey, you can put that on a baseball. But anyway, it's just an idiosyncratic little tick he has where he goes to his forearm, touches his forearm, but he's not doctoring the ball. But as for Buchholz, I mean, he does he's doing a lot of shit. You know, he's always touching parts of his body. The stuff with the hair, I mean, you know, it does seem like he's doctoring the ball a little bit. If he puts a bunch of funk in his hair, then he pours water over his head, which I'm all for, and then going out and grabbing some of that sticky and putting it on the baseball. You know, I mean, technically that's doctoring the ball.
Technically. I mean, I
don't have a problem with it. I'm just saying if Morris is more in tune to that kind of stuff than I am, and if he's having that sort of fit, I doubt it's because Buchholz is successful.
Well,
I mean, seems like it's something else.
I think that the reason he had a fit is because the Blue Jays have been struggling, and he threw seven shutout innings, a four-hit fucking ball against them. You know, if you're going to accuse a guy of doing that, do it after you've caved his head in. I mean, really, if you're going to go out there and you're going to make that accusation, if you're a struggling team and that happens, I agree. I think he put the team in a bad spot. I was around the team in 2004 in Chicago that got into a feud with the broadcasters because the broadcasters said some stuff that, you know, they probably didn't need to. They took a few things too personally. That was a team that was kind of wound a little tight anyway because of pressure that the Cubs had, and they had some battles with the broadcasters. You're the last person in the world that should be a distraction to your team? The fucking broadcaster. That's the last guy, whether you're a borderline Hall of Fame candidate or not. Shut up. Handle it a different way. My issue wasn't – I actually gave Morris a lot of credit for going to the Red Sox guys and saying, hey, I think this is happening. I don't want him to get hot around the collar if people think it's a problem. or don't think it's a problem, but I do think it's good that he went to them. My issue was then he proceeded to tell every media member he could find that that was going on too. So it became a look at me, look at me, look at me situation, whether Jack intended it to be that or not. And that's where it bothers me. You're the broadcaster. Your job is to analyze what's going on between the white lines. And I think there, you know, listen, there are a few guys that know, for all the shit that Morris gets about, you know, whether or not he's a Hall of Famer or all that, I think we can agree, growing up in the era watching him play, guy was a pretty fucking good pitcher. And I think there's a lot that you can learn from him from watching a game, and I think there are things, despite the fact that some Jays fans may not enjoy his broadcast, there are things that you can learn from him. He should really be focused on that as opposed to trying to make news about catching a guy cheating, especially when the team is, you know, when it can look like it's an excuse for the fact that the team hasn't been performing.
I mean, I can see that point of view. I can actually see both sides of it. I can see the fact that he's grandstanding a little bit and being a little bit, you know, getting too into the histrionic of it. But I can also see the fact that he's a baseball old schooler and he noticed something and it set him off. Now, the degree in which it set him off, that's something we can debate. But I am interested to know, you know, all the details of what he thinks or what he saw about what Buchholz was doing, what he thinks it does to the ball. You know, I'm fascinated with that kind of stuff because if you think about it, the average person doesn't really know what does honey do to a baseball? You know, what does Darvish's natural honey do to a baseball?
Well, I mean, sometimes it affects fastball command, but then you can throw like 75% of your breaking balls for strikes and strike out 14 guys. So
it's really interesting. I mean, all the stuff about, as I said, I don't really like Curt Schilling, but I saw him do a breakdown of like what sandpaper can do to a ball, what, you know, digging your nail into the ball can do, all that kind of stuff. It was really fascinating. I mean, there's a whole world out there that happens on a baseball field of little tiny things that can influence a game that we don't always focus on or we don't even notice.
You know, I always tend to think that stuff, what happens with the ball getting cut or, you know, finding some sandpaper or scuffing, it tends to happen with older pitchers that are losing their stuff than it does with guys who are throwing 94 or 95. Now, at least that's my perception of it. I don't have any proof on that. But if you look at the guys who've been suspended for using something on the ball over the years, it seems to me that they've been guys like, what, Kevin Gross and Joe Niekro and you know, Joel Peralta last year for having sandpaper in the glove. It's not a whole lot of 25- and 26-year-old guys that are throwing smoke.
No, you're right. It's like the Kenny Rogers on the Tigers type
of
guy.
Yeah.
Doctoring.
Right.
Hey, I'm all for it. I think it's really cool. I think it's really interesting.
Zach, great question. Our next comes from Tommy, and he asks Jason and Mike, I was wondering how or if scouts quantify the command and control of a pitcher. Is there a specific percent of targets hit range that they look at and reference that against a chart? Or is it more the eyes test, how well it looks like a guy is commanding his stuff? Does the context of the pitch matter in this evaluation, i.e. if a guy seemingly has worse command in big spots, does that hurt the overall grade? If the command grade is based on how many targets a guy hits, what are the approximate ranges for each grade level? If I were to go chart a hypothetical guy and he hit the target with 37% of his fastballs and was in the zone with 57% of his fastballs, how would you grade his command and control? Thanks for your time, Tommy Cook. P.S. So sorry about the mark typo a while back. P.P.S. Those numbers on fastball command from Pierce Johnson in King County against Clinton a month ago missed high and away quite a bit early on.
I don't keep I don't look at command control quite like that. I don't break it down quite that specifically. But when I watch the catcher a lot. You know, I from the vantage point that I usually get at the minor league parks, I'm trying to watch to see, you know, does a pitcher hit his spot? You know, if a pitcher hit his spot, you know, I kind of look at that as, oh, you know, he's got command of this specific offering. I don't really break it down to how many times he is hitting his spot to determine command. Command is something I can just kind of tell if he has or if he doesn't have. And the same with control. I mean, is he throwing strikes? Control is pretty easy to determine. Is he throwing within the zone? That's pretty simple, but I don't really sit down and come up with a percentage of how many times he's throwing in the zone and then use that to determine a grade. I usually just eyeball it, you know, does he have command or... Is he throwing strikes? Okay, good. He's got some control here. Does he, is he able to locate the offering where he wants in certain counts, in certain situations, changing speeds, that sort of thing, you know, pitchability. That's how I look at command. I don't really break it down like that.
I wonder if it would be helpful for an organization to quantify it a bit more, just so that all of their scouts were on the same page.
Maybe. I mean, you're asking them to then pay a lot more attention to the minutia of it, mm-hmm. instead of watching the whole game, and so you get back to the point where you're spending more time on the notebook.
No, that's a good point. I just, if you were to say somebody, for you, I mean, what does, like, six command look like? I mean, do you have a way to describe what a guy with plus command looks like?
Yeah, I mean, I know it when I see it, and, you know, to break it down further, I mean, you know, I don't put a seven on many things.
Right.
You know, seven is, if a guy's got seven command, he's hitting just about every single one of his spots. You know, he's working in, out, north, south. He's able to change speeds. And, you know, I'm speaking of one specific pitch here. You know, can he go to it when everything else isn't working? When can he go to it? When does he go away from it? I try to notice all those type of things. But I'm not going to put a seven or an eight on many things. If I think that that's, you know, above major league quality command, stuff that I would see at the major league level on a consistent basis, then I'll put a six on it. If it's even better than that, if it's really blowing me away, then I'll put a seven on it, but I want to see more than one viewing before I'll put a seven on just about anything. But I think that, you know, if you're gonna have that sort of charting, then you don't really need scouts. You just need people who are going to be able to recognize what's in the zone. You can do that after the fact on, you know, using PitchFX or, you know, TrackMan.
Right.
Which teams are doing after the fact. But I don't think it's a waste of a scout's time to sit him in a game and make him chart every single pitch and where its location is in order to determine a percentage, in order to then determine, you know, the grade of command. I mean, that's stuff that you can do after the fact, that, you know, teams have this type of technology now that we don't always have access to. So, you know, if you have a trained scout, I mean, then you got to let them go with their feel on it too, because they're not just drawing from that one person. They're drawing in relation to other pitchers that they've seen.
Right. I think it's a really interesting question, because I think part of it, you know, trying to determine where those grades come into play, you know, and we talked about that a couple weeks ago, you know, the difficulty in grading and when you feel comfortable putting grades on things, just kind of, you know, it's good to say, hey, listen, if this guy's got above average major league command, but what is major league command? How do you define it? And I think that's part of the problem you know, it's certainly one of the problems that I have when I'm trying to, you know, just evaluate. Now, you know, and I never sit on a series. I'm doing one-offs, right? So, you know, when I'm trying to evaluate a guy, or I might see him now and again, you know, how do I compare that command to what major leaguers do? Because what is the average of what a major leaguer does when he's commanding his pitches? And I think that that's part of – but it's a very what's the word I'm looking for? It's like an esoteric kind of thing, or there's like a floating there's not like just one way to define it, so to speak, right? I mean, I guess that's what I'm trying to get at, is that
it's
tough to try and just go into a ballpark and say, well, that guy's got five command, because even if you know what a guy with average major league command looks like, because average major league command looks like a lot of different things.
Well, right, and from a selfish perspective here, I mean, one of the reasons I really love scouting and player development is that it can be very abstract, it can be subjective, and, you know, it's an art, you know, and if you transition it into a science, you lose a lot of that, for me at least. And I don't want there to be an exact scale. I don't want there to be one scale that every team follows, and if you throw this percentage of strikes in the zone, then it equals this. Or if you hit a ball this distance, then it equals this. I don't like that. I like discussion. I like to have a debate over what, you know, oh, you think that's five command? You know what? I think it's better than that. Well, this is why I think it's better than that. We can discuss that kind of stuff. But when it starts getting into the science of it, that's when I go soft.
Do you know any teams that have a more scientific approach to how they define something like command?
You know, I've talked to a few individual scouts who have their own determinations. I don't know if it's team-based, but they have their own little, you know, if you see them do it a couple of times, you know it's possible. You know, you start putting it, you know, you put this fastball on, you know, the outside black, and you can do it a couple of times, and you seem to be able to do it every time. Keep a tally of how many times you can hit the outside part of the plate, or how many times, you know, the catcher doesn't have to move that stuff. But, you know, I've yet to talk to a team that's got a super detailed scientific way of, if they throw this many strikes, you know, then it equals this amount of command.
I did hear the story about there's at least one team that had an idea of that was a little bit more defined as to what a 5 or a 6 was when it came to command and what they tried to teach to their scouts. But I've never heard anybody try and put it down necessarily scientifically. But I know that there is at least one team that has tried to at least define what that is across their scouting group or what their scouts see. So. But great question, Tommy. Dear Professor Parks and Mike and or Mark, first I'd like to thank you guys for an awesome 4 episodes so far and hopefully many more to come. It's a careful balance of rig and slack and something I very much look forward to on a weekly basis. My question is about catchers. Since the beginning of last season, I've watched an unhealthy amount of Mariners games for reasons that I cannot begin to explain. Because of this habit, I've seen an awful lot of Jesus Montero catching. Once he reached the upper minors, Montero seemed to be one of those catching prospects that just had to move out from behind the plate. I was always hearing that he can't catch, and he's just a designated hitter. Yet I see him play behind the plate multiple times a week. Evan Gattis is another player that comes to mind as someone that had no shot to catch in the majors. Yet I watched him catch in McCann's absence for a few weeks, and he didn't look that terrible. Even Montero, who clearly struggles mightily with receiving, seems to handle the game reasonably well. My question is this: does Montero catching for Seattle really have such a negative impact, or would it only show over a longer period of time? Is the offensive bar for catchers just so low that any hint of offensive impact can get a below-average to poor defensive catcher time behind the plate anyway? Am I even asking the right question? Catchers have completely fascinated me lately, so I wanted you guys' takes on them and the current state of the position as a whole. Thanks again for the great podcast, and I'll hopefully meet one or both of you at a BP event at a ballpark soon. Jordan in Maryland, who is the co-founder of Cespedes Family Barbecue. I would definitely eat there. What about catchers? Good catchers, bad catchers?
I love catchers, man. I mean, we talk about catchers a lot. I think that it's an inefficiency. I think that there has to be a new wave of catchers coming up. I think that more teams are going to start putting a priority on good receivers, good game callers, guys who can really help their pitching staff, and not just you can hit down the line, or you can hit in the middle of a lineup, so we're going to stick you there even though you're a 3. Defensive catcher. But, I've talked to a lot of pitchers who, they really value a good receiver, a good framer, a comfortable target, somebody that they can work, get into the flow of the game with and work through, and, it makes them better. I'm all for, I can see the argument that, hey, a guy who, can, be a run producer or put balls in the seats, those type of guys, they do a lot for the pitcher too, by providing that offense. And so that's where you get guys like Montero or, maybe Gary Sanchez when he gets there, or, guys who don't really profile as average defensive players who have above average potential with the stick, because if you have a 6 bat and you're a catcher, man, you could be a 3 catcher. All you have to do is be able to catch and you're going to have a ton of value, you're going to have a ton of positional value. But if you break it down into the smaller parts of the game, I don't think many pitchers are going to want to throw to a guy who, isn't a good game caller, or who doesn't get into the flow of the game with him, or who doesn't spot trends, who doesn't, frame well, or, receive and or throw out runners well. I think that pitchers appreciate this. I think that defense is overlooked. I really do. And I think that when you put too much of a focus on offense at the expense of defense, I think that it can have, residual effects, especially if it's a catcher who has to deal with the pitcher throughout a game. So, I'm all for seeing more, I like the two-way catchers. That's awesome. If you can find a Posey or you can find a Molina, good for you, good on you. But I love a good defensive catcher. I will take those over the bat any day, foolishly perhaps.
There's an old kind of sabermetric joke about catchers. That's, Rob Neyer used to use it a lot, called Nichols' Theory of Catching, which is that your defensive prowess is basically inversely proportionate to your offensive value. So if you can hit, it means you're a bad receiver. But if you can catch, it means you can't hit for shit, right? I mean, that's the idea that we get with a lot of catchers. I think what ends up happening is the guys that catch for a long time, they may not necessarily look the part when it comes to the most obvious, aspect of catching, which is throwing out base runners. But there are other things that they do well. I know from working with Jim Duquette, one of the things that he always talked about with Mike Piazza was terrible at throwing out runners. But they felt like he was a really good receiver and a pretty good game caller, and he didn't get enough credit for that. And it's one of the reasons why he stayed behind the plate for so long. If he had really been that bad of a butcher behind the plate, he'd have been at first base a lot earlier in his career. And I know that it didn't go well defensively for him at first base. But we tend to focus on the things that are much more quantifiable than what teams are looking at. And I think part of that is the relationship with the pitcher. And I think the simplest part of that relationship is when you hear somebody say guys like throwing to him, I don't even know if it's that he's a receiver or a good game caller so much as he communicates well with pitchers. And I think that that's something that's really important from the catcher is being on the same page with what the pitcher is trying to do. Not everybody is Yadier Molina, who's the one who's setting the game plan. For the most part, you're trying to follow what the pitcher wants to do and play to his strengths. And if you can communicate that with the pitcher, I think you have a lot more value in that.
No, I agree. That's well said.
Our last email question comes to us from Eli in Connecticut. He says, guys, I'm a big fan of the WAR statistic. And I know you guys get asked with WAR-related questions all the time, but this one's a real doozy. Inspired by a John Heyman tweet this week, I thought compared Mike Trout's ludicrous 2012 season with a strong start from Starling Marte this season. Trout in 2012 had his historic year, 326, 399, 564 for the slash line. Starling Marte's 13 pace, and this is as of last week, 323, 391, 444. Trout's pace for wins above replacement rate about 11. Marte was on pace to break that. If Marte kept the same exact pace for the entire season, he would finish with a higher wins above replacement than Trout did, despite the fact that Trout essentially matched or would beat Marte in every offensive category, especially power. And the narrative last season was that Trout also had an historic year defensively. My question is, what do you make of this? Was Trout not as good defensively as we thought last year, or is Marte having one of the greatest 25-game stretches in history defensively to make up ground that he's losing on offense? Again, I love WAR, but this concerns me about the accuracy of the statistic. I know WAR is essentially a baseline, and defensive metrics aren't where we want them to be, but why do you think this is? Eli in Manchester. I think this leads to a deeper discussion on the wins above replacement statistic. Heyman's initial tweet was that Marte had provided as much value in WAR than Bryce Harper has to that point in the season, which I think if we were to watch the two players, and I love Marte, I'm not sure that, and as much as you love defense, I'm not sure that as much defense as Marte is providing in left field in Pittsburgh that it's going to outweigh what Bryce Harper has done offensively to this point this year.
No. I don't love WAR. I don't. I think it's a good stat. I don't like falling in love with one singular metric because it becomes like a soapbox metric. You know, if you define baseball based on one singular metric and that becomes your everything, that's your baseline for what a player is, then it becomes that's it. You know, it's very narrow. It's very thin. If you're just going to use one means, and I'm not saying that, Eli is this way, but there are a lot of people. There are a lot of people who have high-ranking positions that, it's WAR or go home.
There are.
And I can't stand the, his WAR is this, so this is what he is. Well, no, how about this is what his WAR is, and then here are other things that he is as well. There are a lot of ways to evaluate a player. There's a lot of ways to analyze a player. And I do not get into bed with one singular metric because you're not going to find one that doesn't have flaws. And obviously, using this example, it's flawed. But, I can't get into bed with it.
Yeah, and I think WAR's greatest strength is its greatest, its greatest detraction at the same time, which is that, it tries to do everything. It's trying to create one simple number to explain the value of a player, and yet in that process of doing that, it makes it very difficult to explain why the value is happening. You're looking at two different, very different players, Trout with a huge amount of offensive value, and Marte with a huge amount of defensive value that's being added into that statistic. And as a result, you don't get to see either because you're just comparing the one number. And I think it's a good comparative stat. I think it's good, a good baseline to start discussions. I don't think it has any real predictive quality. I think it's good for spotting trends in an overall value of a player. So, and to give an idea of how, you know, how much value they may have had in one season per se, or over the course of a couple of seasons when compared to others. But I don't think it's any different than looking just at OPS. You know, if I tell you that a player has an OPS of 820, and I use OPS a lot, if I tell you he has an OPS of 820, what does it tell you about his on-base and his slugging percentage?
I mean, it tells me that he knows that he's above league average. I mean,
No, it doesn't tell you anything about either of those things, because he could have a 550 slugging percentage and a 270 on base percentage.
Yeah, but anything over 8, I usually look at as, okay, well, this is not a slouch. Gordon, it comes down to what position he's playing, where what he's doing,
sure,
with, you know, the other stuff. So it's not something that I would look at and, you know, and just make a determination based on that one number.
Right, and that's the thing with wins above replacement too, is that for, you know, with that, or wins above replacement player, the warp statistic for BP, you know, any of that needs to be taken with a bit of a grain of salt. And I don't think it's descriptive enough. You know, I think there's a lot of different ways to be a four-win player. There's a lot of different ways to post an 800 OPS. And just to focus on that one number, you lose the color, you lose the abstract, you know, what you love in scouting, you lose the human element, so to speak, of the player and what makes them that. You know, just to say that it's like focusing solely on base percentage with a guy. And I know this is something you've discussed before. You know, if a guy has a 300 on base percentage but he's slugging 520, he's got a shitload of value. Because that guy is a power hitter. That guy is getting halfway to first base every time he swings the bat. Halfway to a base every time he puts a ball in play, basically. And that is, you know, part of this discussion, is that you can look at these as good indicators, but don't, when you're trying to compare it too deeply, they run out of steam really, really quickly, despite what their good intentions are.
No, I agree. I agree completely. And like, when you're looking at minor league numbers, it gets really cloudy, because obviously you're not dealing with the WAR metric. But when, you know, you're looking at like the OPS, and which is a lot of, sometimes that's all we have to look at. You see that a prospect's, you know, got an OPS of 800 or above. Well, immediately I'm looking at that like, well, that's a good thing, you know. And then you can investigate further, like, you know, if he's a power hitter guy, if he's a guy who's just looking to slug, you know, he's not a guy at this level that is getting on base a lot. Obviously, that's something he would probably need to work on. But, you know, you're looking at how often he's driving the baseball. You're looking at how often he's, you know, collecting doubles, triples, and home runs. That kind of stuff, that has a lot of value, especially if you're a power hitting guy. You know, I focus on that a lot. I look at those type of numbers and I'm like, okay, this is production. This is good. This is a good thing. But, you know, if we're talking about an 800 OPS of a, you know, guy who's getting on base, you know, 40% of the time, maybe not slugging quite as much, but then, you know, it changes how you're looking at him. But then again, you have to break it down. You can't just look at the one number. So, yeah, I think you make good points.
How often do you look at statistics before you go to cover a minor league series? Do you look at all?
No, I don't.
Yeah, I don't either.
I will look after the fact, but especially at, like, the, you want to see production. Look, I'm not against minor league numbers. I'm not really for, you know, the statistical analysis of minor league statistics, especially at the lower levels. But, you know, the higher you get up, you're going to want to start to see more production. You know, I look at the numbers after the fact to see, like, you know, this guy I saw today, I thought he was really good. Let me see what he's doing. And, you know, and that's when I'll kind of eyeball the OPS and just get a ballpark of if he's, you know, jumping above like that magic number. And then I'll investigate further what's going on. But no, I don't. At the lower levels, man, I really want to focus more on the scouting report when I'm looking at when I'm trying to form an evaluation of the player. But that doesn't mean I don't want to see production. You want to see production at every level. You know, a kid can be 17 and A ball, and you can say, well, he's really, really young for the level. Don't focus on the production. That doesn't mean you still don't want to see the production. You know, if he's hitting, you know, a buck, you know, if he's got a 100, 200, 300 thing going, you still want to see what's going on with it. You can't ignore production completely. I think that it's foolish to ignore production completely. I mean, you obviously want to see forms of it at every level, even at the lowest levels of the minors. Even when the competition is completely unbalanced, you want the good players are the ones who put up numbers. You always want to see that.
Right. I even, you know, for the numbers guy on staff, I stay away from a lot of the numbers early in the season, especially, you know, Russell Carlton, pizza cutter, who I actually had drinks with him last night. Well, he doesn't drink. I had the drinks, but we chatted. He happened to be in D.C. And he put together a great kind of, I guess it's like a library card earlier this, a few years ago about, you know, when guys kind of rate stats start to normalize. And I think it's really messy to start looking at batting average and you know, on-base percentage even, or home runs, or any of the even the secondary traditional statistics too early in the year. I think you need to be focused more on the process at that point to see, you know, until it normalizes whether or not guys have made changes if they're in a hot streak, especially if you don't get a chance to sit on them for 4 or 5 days in a row. And that's, you know, that's one of the challenges that I think sometimes we can, even with the idea that, you know, we like to bat around, well, it's a small sample size, we can jump to conclusions too quickly with the numbers, and that sometimes you've got to just kind of, there has to be a little bit more patience in what you're looking at to see whether or not something is real or it's changed. And that goes in both directions. That goes in if a guy is really hot or really bad, or if he is having a surprising season, either good or bad, based on what his career totals have been.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't love batting average, but I actually don't mind batting average. I mean, over the course of the year, I look at it as how a good measure of hit tool utility. Mm-hmm. You know, I like to see how often a guy is making contact with the baseball. So it's sometimes in the minor league level with the traditional triple slash, it comes in handy for a guy like me. I get a lot of use out of that.
We'll take a quick break here. Here's some music from Bearcoat, and then we will talk a little bit about some prospects, and then we'll wrap things up on this week's edition of the Fringe Average Podcast.
Heavy on a run. You think I'm due to fall or not? Ladies, later on. Live along the fruit, can still go back. But B for Pam is not like B for Bubba.
Welcome back to Fringe Average, and the music again this week from Jason's group, Bearcoat. So make sure you can get it on iTunes. Go look up Bearcoat and order. What are the names of the albums again? I forget.
First one is just the Bearcoat, and then the second one is called Adding Mass.
Did you feel like you were adding mass while you were recording that album?
Yeah, I mean, it was about the first record was very you know, basic, and there was, you know, some orchestration, but it was mostly just like a, you know, a standard, you know, there was like a mellotron and an acoustic guitar and a bass and maybe a couple of leads and just a lot of vocal layering. But in the second record, it was like, you know, it was like a masturbation record. It was like, man, let's see how many vocal tracks we could do. Let's see, you know, there's 5 or 6 guitar tracks that are layered and, you know, panned, and there's different sorts of orchestration and keyboard and stuff like that. So, I mean, it was about the process of the recording itself, the adding mass to the music, it got a little swampy at times.
Did you perm your hair out like Phil Spector?
I would love to perm my hair out.
Wall of fucking sound, motherfuckers.
I like the wall of sound. I mean, I think reverb can be a little bit difficult to control, and I thought that he went overboard a little bit.
Oh, you think? You think he may have lost it somewhere in there?
So I tend to like, you know, I like everything in a little bit of moderation. You know, that's where I come from. I'm not quite. I don't like the Jeff Lynne. That's too much. I get it. We've talked about it. I don't like it too slick. You know, I do. I kind of like a, you know, that nice balance between, oh man, there's a ton of compression, there's a ton of slick, and then, you know, oh, there's some raw, you know, do-it-yourself type of analog shit going on, which I like a lot.
So the hottest two prospects in the minor leagues are in the twin system, huh? In Byron Buxton and Miguel Sano.
man, those guys are motherfuckers. Man, I don't think Twist fans realize it. I know they're down. I know they've had some down times. You know, I'd be down if I had to deal with, you know, watching that team on a regular basis, and, you know, especially lately. But, man, you got some stuff coming, people. You've got some stuff coming. I mean, Miguel Sano is going to run into some trouble in Double A when he gets the promotion because he's got a, you know, proclivity to striking out. He doesn't, he's got a longer leverage swing. I mean, he's still able to, you know, drive the ball. And, you know, obviously this year he's crushing the shit out of it. But, you know, better pitchers, you know, Double A is a really good test for a guy like Sano because he's going to be facing guys with better command, better breaking stuff, better sequencing ability, and, you know, more ability to use his deficiencies against him. And I think that, you know, it's only a matter of time before he passes that test as well and will be at the major league level in a couple of seasons and doing some pretty legit damage. And this guy has substantial raw power. I mean, it's 80 grade raw power, and he's going to be able to utilize it. I mean, he's not a bad hitter. A lot of these guys like Joey Gallo, you know, Joey Gallo's probably got more raw power than most people in the major leagues, but he's not a very good hitter. He's kind of an all or nothing type of guy. And he can, you know, he can twist his hips in and jerk and yank and hit a ball out. And that's impressive as shit, you know, but Sano's a better all around hitter. And I think he has a better chance of, you know, finding that sort of utility in the middle of a major league lineup than a guy like Gallo. And Buxton, man, I'd take Buxton over Sano or Gallo or just about anybody else in the minors right now because that kid, you know, we talk about Bubba Starling having loud tools. I mean, this is what – he's got loud tools. Buxton's got the loud tools. I mean, he's an eight runner. He's got an arm. He, you know, he's got a feel for the game. He can hit. He's going to be able to hit for power. He can do it all. He's an impact game changer, build your franchise around player. And there's going to be bumps in the road. This is not going to be, you know, everybody thinks everybody's the next Trout, you know, that he's going to win Rookie of the Year when he's 20 or something like that and freak everybody out. But, I mean, he's going to get there eventually. He's going to get there when he's young, and he's going to have an impact. And those two guys are going to change the face of that franchise. That those two guys are the best 1-2 combo in the minors. I look to get reports from scouts every single day on those guys that I'm not even writing about. I just want to know. What did they do last night? What did they do the night before? You know, how does he look when he strikes out? I mean, I'm just fascinated with those two players.
And, you know, overall, offensively especially, the system looks like it's in better shape when you add the two guys that are in the big leagues right now in Hicks and Arcia. And, you know, after a slow start for Hicks, you know, it's been better. I mean, his patience, you know, we talked about selectivity, what, a couple weeks ago. But his patience, I think, may have helped him. That and you know, I know that there's not really a way to quantify it so much, but boy, he was under a lot of pressure hitting in that leadoff spot, and he seemed like a different guy once they moved him down to eight.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, there's some good things on the horizon for that franchise, and I think that when you get those young players at the major league level, you get some experience under them. You know, but this wave of talent makes their way up. They're going to be able to help with that adjustment period, and then, you know, 3 or 4 years down the line when they're all gelling together, it's going to be nasty. You know, like, you need to get some pitching. They don't have the, you know, the type of pitching that like they have on the offensive side, but I mean they do have, you know, they have been able to build their farm system up quite a bit in the last couple of years, and I think that, you know, there's a lot of promise on the horizon for that franchise, and I'm certainly going to be really eager to watch all those young guys as they matriculate up.
The reports, at least early, and I haven't talked to anybody lately on Alex Meyer, but they were pretty good as a starter at Double A. That there was. There was more hope that he could stay in the rotation now than there was a year ago.
Yeah, I just got a recent report on him that you know, loved the stuff, didn't see the starter. It's pretty easy to watch a guy in a five-inning burst and see some things that you don't like and put him in the reliever box. When you see a guy his size start to lose his release point, like, you know, Jason Cole saw Helwig recently, and like the first four innings, you know, he's sending me, you know, full frontal picks, you know, because he's that excited. He starts to lose his release point, and then it all goes to shit, which is quite common with a pitcher with those type of limbs, you know, and it's really hard to control that. It's really hard to stay in an athletic rhythm and stay in your delivery when you have that sort of size, and that's why a guy like, you know, Helwig is definitely going to be destined for the the bullpen, and I hate to put Meyer in the same box, but you know there are a lot of reports that think that he's going to end up in the back of a major league bullpen. Now he'll have impact potential because he has impact stuff, but you know I don't want to throw him in there yet. There are reports that suggest that it's possible.
And the question is going to be whether or not he looks more athletic certainly than I thought he was going to at 6'9", but I think that athleticism is going to play a large role as to whether or not he is able to repeat, at that size. There have been guys that have done it before. I mean, it's a short list, but, you know, Randy Johnson comes to mind on that. And maybe, you know, selecting the outlier is dangerous. But, you know, if you've got guys who are 6'7", 6'8", 6'9", who've done it before and they have enough athleticism, you know, maybe you hold out hope. You leave them, obviously, you leave them in that role as long as you possibly can. But, at the same time, you know, it's again, we're talking about Randy Johnson there, which is, you know, a once in a generation kind of pitcher.
The majority of those guys do end up in the pen, and I don't want to just see how it plays out. I don't want to be one of those guys that, you know, you're working off a very small amount of information and you put a guy in a box because he fits, you know, that stereotype, or he's the prototypical, you know, tall guy who is not going to be able to find his command, or he's not going to be able to have sustainable secondary stuff for three or four times through an order, and you put him in the bullpen. I mean, you know, he could be the Randy Johnson guy.
So we mentioned Aaron Hicks, but any of the other young guys that have come up over these first, you know, now 6 weeks of the major league season that have maybe made their debut this year or losing their rookie status now? Because I think it'd be real easy for us to turn this into a conversation on Machado and Harvey, and I don't want to do that because we know they're awesome. But any of these kind of guys that have made their big league debut this year that you're most excited about?
Well, I mean, obviously Jose Fernandez is a guy that I'm excited about long term.
Last start was pretty fucking good too.
Yeah, I think that he's going to be, you know, he's going to have his ups and downs. But once he really starts to find confidence in that changeup, you know, once it becomes a pitch that he feels as comfortable with as he does the curveball, you know, he's really going to be a tough pitcher to stop when he's on. When he has the fastball command, he's going to be a guy that can miss a ton of bats. He can control the tempo of the game. I really like what he's going to do, you know, long term. I like what he's going to be able to do in the short term. You look at another guy on that roster, you know, Ozuna. I mean, Ozuna's a guy that I didn't think was going to be able to do this. And I know it's only, you know, it's a very small sample, but I didn't really like him as a prospect. I kind of thought he was more of a second division type of guy. And I didn't see him as a guy who would, one, be up this early. I know it's the Marlins, you know, or have any kind of success early on, even if it's in a small sample. I didn't see him as I wasn't a believer, you know, and obviously I'm wrong now. Have you seen him yet?
No, I haven't. And I do think the most interesting part of that Ozuna move was, you know, I think we assumed that Yelich was going to be the next guy up with them, but they went with the hot hand, which is kind of a move that I kind of like because it gives you a chance to let the kid build some confidence, you know, as he comes to the big league level because he's swinging the bat well. I don't know what the numbers show about the success rate on that, but on paper at least, I like the idea of bringing up the guy that's swinging the bat well.
Sure.
And they did that with Ozuna, and it certainly carried over in the first, you know, couple of games that he's played. But I haven't had a chance to watch him yet. I mean, I'm excited to see him. I saw a lot of Yelich in spring training, and I love him. And the Marlins,
he's a natural hitter, man. Yelich is a natural hitter.
And I think that I don't think he's ever going to be a huge power guy. You know, I mean, he's not a, you know, a 25 or 30 homer guy, but, you know, there's going to be enough there that it's certainly somebody, I can't remember who said it, but somebody last year kind of compared him to Markakis offensively. It's not a great physical comp, but at least in terms of the style of hitter, I can see that. And I think there's going to be Yelich is going to be one of those guys that people drool over because he can just hit. He's going to hit the ball hard every time up. But I know the Marlins people love Mariznick. And Tino Martinez actually told us in spring training that once he gets that little hitch, that little like bat wrap that he's got out of his swing, he thinks he's going to be one of the best players ever. That was what he said. He said, I think he's going to be one of the best players ever.
That's good. You know, I hope that that happens because I'd like to see one of the best players ever. It's probably not going to be Mariznick.
No.
You know, having seen him several times, I don't I don't, you know, he's probably a role five, maybe a solid average type of player, maybe a couple of peak seasons above that, but I don't see the best player ever, no.
I mean, listen, if he's a role five player as a center fielder, pretty good player, you know?
Yeah, no, that's a good player. I mean, that is a good player. Out of that crop, I mean, I'm a Yelich guy when it comes to that. I think that, you know, we talked about this a bunch. I mean, you can hit or you can't hit, and he can really, really, really hit. It's a very natural, easy type of hitting. I think that from that power will breed from that. I'm not sure how much. I agree with you. I don't think that he's going to be a big home run guy, but I think that he can surprise some people with the way he drives a baseball, and I think that the way he goes about making contact, power is going to stem from that eventually. I'm surprised that he's not up. The way that the Marlins are running it.
No, I can certainly understand that. So
anybody else in the minors stand out for you, good or bad?
In the minor leagues?
I mean, in the majors, the prospects who have just gotten the cup,
I mean,
gotten the early season taste.
Fernandez is the guy that that I've seen the most of that have really impressed me. I mean, Arenado swung the bat well for Colorado. The two kids in Texas up until the last week or so have pitched pretty well. But I think that's one of those, hey, good planning to get those guys hot to start the season until you can get the reinforcements back. Because I think as you're watching kind of Grimm and Tepish go through the league, you know, for another month, you're going to start to see some of the warts in their game show up now and again. Because I don't think either of them are, I don't want to say ready, but I don't think either of them are impact starters, certainly.
I saw a bunch in camp. I saw Martin Perez. He was looking really sharp. He certainly had the angle for the fifth starter job until, you know, he broke his hand or broke his arm. But, you know, Nick Tepish, I don't know. Even if Martin Perez comes back full strength right now, I'm not sure that he's a better option immediately than Nick Tepish. I think that Tepish has been, you know, better than expected. I think that he's a very mature type of pitcher. I think that he's able to keep hitters, you know, off balance. He can add a lot of movement to his pitches, you know, with the slider and the cutter. He's not going to be a big knockout pitcher, and the league is certainly going to adjust to that, and he's going to have to make adjustments. But, you know, he's kind of a heady pitcher, and he doesn't really get rattled, and I think that he's going to be able to make the necessary adjustments. I think that he's a, you know, a pretty solid number four, number five type of starter that the Rangers, you know, have under team control for a shit long time. And I it's not that Martin Perez isn't ready or, you know, isn't going to be as good. I just think that Nick Tepish is a better option right now, and I've been really, really surprised at how he's pitched. I think that it's a very positive development for the Rangers.
And Grimm struggled in the first inning tonight but settled down after that, which is certainly a good sign for them. Five runs in the first inning, and after that he's thrown up a zero.
Yeah, I mean, and Grimm, he's a lot more volatile. He's a guy that he can certainly give it up very quickly. He doesn't have, you know, when he doesn't have his fastball, it really goes to shit. I like his curveball. You know, I like that I think he needs to be in the minors, obviously. The Rangers' hands they were forced, but I think that he's a guy that, you know, needs to work on putting a little bit more movement on his pitches, especially the fastball, working with that two-seamer a little bit more than that four-seamer to keep it off of barrels, because, you know, he's one of those guys that he can throw strikes, but the problem is this isn't, you know, the lower minors or college or high school. I mean, you throw strikes to a major league hitter, he's going to put the wood on it. And so that's when you need a little bit of, a little bit of wiggle to the ball and set up that fastball, which would then allow him to set up his curveball, which is a really good pitch. And his changeup isn't bad either. So, I mean, you know, he needs to be in the minors. He's one of those guys that I think he needs to be in the minors.
All right. Before we get out of here, I want to mention I had a chance to go out to Delmarva last Thursday to go see them play Lexington. Delmarva's the low A affiliate for the Orioles, and Lexington, of course, has Bubba Starling and your dream man, Adalberto Mondesi, on it. I gotta give you the background story on it. I got that there was a horrible accident right at the split of 301 and 50 on my way out. It took me 4.5 hours to make a 2-hour trip from D.C.
Wow.
To Delmarva to get there, right? So I got there just about 10 minutes before the game started. Zach Mortimer from BP was there. And so we were sitting there. I got there. I missed batting practice. Didn't get to see any of it. And then in the game, Mondesi bunted 3 fucking times.
I want.
Once for a hit, a couple times in sacrifice situations, he had a double in between. So I don't know that I can give you much of a scouting report on him or Bubba Starling from being there in person. But it was fun to be able to go and see them. I will tell you who you know looks like he's got a future at least as a reliever, and that's Brandon Klein, who was the second rounder from the Orioles last year out of Virginia. Mm-hmm. He was a closer there. He's been starting. Fastball velocity wasn't great as a starter, but boy, he can repeat his delivery like there's no tomorrow. I understand why they're trying him as a starter just based on that.
Yeah, I mean, the reports on him have been good. I mean, I had good reports of him coming out of college, and I haven't had a chance to put eyes on him yet, but where was he sitting velocity-wise?
Yeah, it wasn't great. It was 89 to 92. It was a little bit of a cool night, but he located it really well. I mean, he was
he had
really good extension on his fastball, low and away to right-handed hitters, and I thought that was important. And he has a pretty good slider. I mean, he could throw it for strikes when he wanted it. He could make it look like a strike. You know, it's probably not necessarily your traditional slider velocity. It was more in the high 70s than anything. I don't remember him throwing a whole ton of changeups in that, but at least those two pitches would give him a chance against right-handed hitters at the big leagues, I think, eventually. He's too old for that level, too.
Well, I mean, yeah, that's part of it, but I mean, when you're just looking in a vacuum or at a vacuum of the stuff, you know, when you're just looking to see what his velocity is, what his slider velocity is, I mean, maybe if he adds a little bit more arm speed and get him maybe a bit more on that slider, a little bit more bite to it, a little bit more horizontal action instead of, I'm sure if it's in the 70s, it's a little bit loopier.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that it was even loopy. I mean, it wasn't that kind of it wasn't that real sharp snap late break kind of, you know, two plane slider necessarily, but it wasn't a soft breaking ball. It had an effect to it. Maybe it was more of a curve. I don't know what he calls it. I mean, I don't fucking care what he calls it. It was effective. You know, the thing is that he could, I mean, it's the kind of pitch that would get, it would, there is enough there that I think eventually it's going to be able to keep big league hitters off balance. It just doesn't have that, you know, snapdragon kind of carry wood movement on it, you know.
Right. Well, that's interesting, though. That's interesting that he's, that it's effective at that velocity and with that size movement. And if you think that it's going to be able to keep major league hitters off balance, that's very telling.
Yeah, I think at some point
we'll check back in on during his career, and
we'll see whether or not we get there. So,
right.
So, yeah, that's about it for this week. We missed last week, and I got to say, you know, we talked a little bit last week, and I'm real sorry. I know you had a death in your family, and we're sorry we couldn't bring your podcast, but I certainly understand the circumstances. I know we're not easy for you.
No. I mean, it was just one of those things. I mean, I don't really talk about my family a whole lot because I don't really have a lot left. And unexpectedly, you know, I had just gotten back from L.A. I mean, I had just gotten back from L.A. And I found out that my dad had died. But the thing is that I hadn't even spoken to him in like 7 years. So I mean, that kind of, you would think that it would make it easier, but that actually made it a little harder. But then. Yeah, I was down in Texas, and the good part of it is I got to spend time with like my brothers and sisters, and that was really cool. And then, you know, I finally get to fly back up to New York. I hadn't really been home in a couple of weeks, and I get to get back into baseball, get back into that focus, and you know, live with the knowledge that I don't ever have to deal with anything like that again because I'm out of parents.
Jeez, that's. Well, I'm that's understandable.
Maybe I'll get a couple more. Maybe I'll pick up more along the way. I don't know.
I mean, my folks will adopt you. They'd be happy to. But my mom could be a real ball breaker. So watch out.
I would gladly take that.
So I'm real sorry. I'm sorry that you had to go through that last week.
And
I, you know, more than anything, I mean, because you know I'm a selfish fuck. I just missed being able to spend 2 hours of my week with you, which is one of the things that I really enjoy because I like to be able to bullshit with you. But I'm glad you're doing okay.
Same here. That was definitely missed.
So, well, I'm glad you're doing better. I'm glad you're doing okay, and I'm glad you're back home. And what are you going to do the rest of your week?
I'm playing catch up. I'm trying to get back into the article writing game. So I'm, you know, I'm making calls. I'm getting back in with my sources. I'm finding out what's going on at different games, different affiliates. I'm starting to. I'm flying to Seattle in a couple of weeks with you. And so leading up to that, I'm trying to bust as much balls as I absolutely can, and to leave a plate full of work, so that when I, you know, fly to Seattle and miss a couple of days, I don't fall too far behind like I did last couple of weeks. What do you have going on?
I'm going to go up to Baltimore tomorrow night to go see the Orioles and Royals. And, of course, I catch the night that Luis Mendoza is pitching for Kansas City. But I still like the Royals' offense.
Dozer.
the Dozer.
I love him. I love that guy.
Why do you love him? Because he's all want?
No, man. When he's on and he's got the power sinker going, I love watching his mechanics. I mean, he's got a lot better stuff than he brings to the table, you know, a lot of the time. And I've seen it flash before. I've seen him sit 94 to 98 before.
Jesus.
You know, with heavy sink, cause he's got that long arm drag. It doesn't happen very often, but I have a soft spot for the guy.
Well, he's going to pitch against Chris Tillman, who's always – you want to talk about a guy that you never know what you're going to get. I mean, his last outing was fantastic on the West Coast. So I'm going to go to that, and I'm going to try and catch, I think, Washington and Detroit on Thursday afternoon now. So that's kind of where – that's where I'm heading. But I'm looking forward to Seattle, and tickets are still available Perspectives event. We should mention that we're both going to be – you're going to Houston this weekend too, aren't you?
I'm not. Going to go to Houston, but all this stuff, like with the Texas trip, immediately followed by the L.A. trip, immediately followed by the old man going down and then flying back to New York, I'm behind. I need to focus on Baseball Prospectus and my work and the work of my team at Baseball Prospectus and getting all that back together, so I can't fly to Houston. The good news is that Jason Collette and Jason Cole will be at the event down there, along with other. So the Jasons are covered. There's enough Jason at the event.
And I'm assuming the dead man will be there too, in Goldstein. That he's going to show up at some point to press the flesh and remind you that he used to be famous, right?
Well, yeah, Kevin. How would Kevin avoid that? Kevin's, you know, staying up, this is Christmas. I mean, he cannot. He's pacing the floor. He's got an advent calendar going on about this. I mean, he cannot wait.
Just turn on the lantern, kids. Here comes the moth.
Right.
And I think Jaren's
famous. Right. Then quit posting about it.
I think Darren Sutton is going to be there too. I think
Darren is the man, man. Sut is the man. He was a really big help at the Dodger event. That guy knows his stuff. Darren Sutton is legit.
Let me tell you what. I've just gotten to know him this year because he's doing the Sunday night show with me and Joe now on MLB Network Radio, which, if you don't know, Baseball Prospectus has a Sunday night radio program during the season at 11 Eastern on Sunday nights. And so this is my first, like, exposure to Sut. I've known people who've known him who've always said he was a good guy. Dude, the guy's a great guy. I mean,
he's a worker.
Oh, absolutely. You should see the shit he comes up with every week. Like, we get an email from him on Sunday afternoons with, like, he's been pouring into the numbers, and, you know, and he played, you know, I mean, he played at a small college. He pitched in the minor leagues. You know, his dad, obviously, I don't know if you know this, but his dad was a pretty good pitcher.
Yeah, he was
Don. Don Sutton was pretty good.
He knew his way around Dodger Stadium pretty well.
Yeah. Darren's a good dude, man, and he's a smart guy. I really, really like working with him. Yeah, he's a lot of fun. And he's doing a bunch of Big 12 shit, which is cool. I mean, I like that they've got a big league announcer doing some of the games on Big 12, because I've gotten really into the college baseball scene because I've been doing this college baseball show for like 3 years now. It's a lot of fun to see that it continue to grow and get exposure, because it's a completely different game than the pro game. Completely different.
I know. I mean, college. The one downside about college baseball is Kendall Rogers.
Oh God!
I think we can both agree that he's the one stain on the sport.
You know, I have to have him on my show now every week. It's a blight on America. I can cancel your satellite radio subscriptions based on that.
Write in and tell us why, Kendall Rogers.
he actually made a I shit you not, that we get to the end of the interview on Monday night. I have him on at the end of every Monday show, and he's like, I heard you take a big gulp. Was that sweet tea? He actually says this on the air.
Like, his whole life is based around sweet tea. I mean, he showed up to the Texas event in Arlington wearing his A&M class ring with his shirt tucked into his dad jeans drinking sweet tea. It was just ridiculous. I was embarrassed.
Does he not realize that we're making fun of him? Is he just like, if you guys rip on me 17 or 18 more times, then I'm out of here?
I don't know. I try to ignore everything that he says, especially when he's talking about baseball.
I love Kendall. I love that guy.
Yeah, he's a good friend.
Yeah, he's a great friend. I mean, he's the kind of friend that you can rip the fuck out of.
Well, yeah, because he's going to come right back on you.
No, he doesn't. Are you kidding, man? He's got 40 grade rip. I mean, shit. You want to talk about fringe average? Fuck, he doesn't have a fastball to throw in this.
He'll get you a swing and miss every once in a while with some junk.
Yeah, every now and again. If you're swinging from the heels, just stay within yourself. Keep the hands inside the ball. So, all right, that's going to do it for us. For Jason, I'm Mike. We'll talk to you again next week on the Fringe Average Podcast.
Hey, girl, it's on. The sun is gone and moon.